Our next case this morning is A19-0354, Ash and Deal versus 3M Company. Good morning. Good morning, Council. We've called the case, so if you can both set up, and whenever you're ready, you Council. Oh, well, you know that you have 15 minutes each for primary arguments.
Yes. I tend to spill. Do you mind if I have this water bottle?
No, that's okay. That's okay. Sure. Council for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal in addition to your primary argument. And so we'll just take a second till everyone's ready. Okay, and then if you will state your name and the party you represent, please, for the record.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Will Flegel, and along with Jim Ballmer, I represent the appellant Ash and Deal in this matter. She was a bystander paralyzed by an intoxicated driver. We seek reversal of a Rule 12 dismissal for failure to state a claim. Since review is based solely on the pleadings and the only matter filed at the time of the motion was plaintiff's complaint, that circumscribes the extent of the facts, all of which must be assumed to be true. Paragraphs 5 and 6 alleged a claim for negligence arising under product liability law for the failure to warn or guard against a defective product causing injury to a bystander. That is a cognizable claim under Minnesota law and has been for decades. Therefore, the trial court erred as a matter of law in dismissing the matter. In a Rule 12 motion, the court must accept the facts alleged in the complaint as true and construe all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party. Making the issue simply, does the complaint set forth a legally sufficient claim? A pleader is neither required to prove nor even to allege all facts on elements of a cause of action. With regard to the complaint here, paragraph 6 alleged that the defendant was negligent in its manufacture and sale of an unreasonably dangerous product, which caused plaintiff's injury. Paragraph 3 of the complaint alleged that 3M knew that its product was misused and abused by inhaling it to induce acute intoxication that incapacitates the abuser. Paragraph 3 also stated that the misuse was foreseeable and that 3M knew or should have known it was misused.
Finally, I don't see that. Are you talking about your complaint?
Yes, ma'am.
I don't see that in paragraph 3. Paragraph Is there an amended complaint?
No, ma'am. Paragraph 3 says that 3M knew or should have known it was misused.
I don't see the reasonably foreseeable language.
The words for reasonably foreseeable do not appear there.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
But the inference one would draw, since all favorable inferences must be drawn in our favor, is if they knew or should have known of it, it was foreseeable.
I understand. I just thought that you were reading
from
something.
Sorry to be so defensive, but you understand why.
I didn't. I thought you were reading from something I didn't have.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor. So this was clearly a product liability complaint on behalf of a bystander, and that's been a recognized cause of action.
So are there cases where, I mean, let's say that by a person next to the product here, someone's spraying their computer, and the person next to the product somehow there's an allergen in there and, you know, is a bystander to that. Is there any case where, I mean, the agent, the product that was the agent of the harm here was a car, the person, plaintiff was nowhere near the dust off. What case is it that makes a person in that situation a bystander to the use of the improperly designed, defectively designed product?
Because the definition of bystander under Minnesota law includes anyone who might be foreseeably affected by, in this case, the dangerous product. In Glorvegan versus Cirrus Design, which is a 2012 Supreme Court case, the most recent one to discuss bystander issues, the court defined product liability as a manufacturer or seller's tort liability for any damages or injuries suffered by a buyer, user, or bystander as a result of the defective product. And in the decision of the Supreme Court in 1984, in the Bellotta case, the Supreme Court said, A manufacturer is obliged to exercise that degree of care in his plan or design so as to avoid any unreasonable risk of harm to anyone who is likely to be exposed to the danger when the product is used in a manner for which the product was intended, as well as unintended yet foreseeable use.
So, I know this is sort of a different question maybe, but it seems to me a little bit, I mean, I know that we're here on a question of duty, but I'm just trying to figure out, it seems like a different way to phrase the question, is the bystander, the person to whom there's a duty allegedly owned, actually, even in the language you just read, there for the use of the product? I mean, a product was used sometime prior to, obviously, this person's connection with the collision.
Right. So are you,
I'm just trying to see, I wonder if there's a case that's more like this, where a person is injured by something else, nowhere near the product, that's the product that's defectively designed.
We've cited several glue-sniffing cases, but if the issue that you're wrestling with has to do with attenuated causation or foreseeability, then we quickly get into the triad of cases with which we're increasingly familiar, and that becomes an issue for the jury.
Well, not always, sometimes.
Even in a close case, it becomes an issue for a jury. In this case, since all facts must be construed in the light most favorable along with the inferences, and the only record consists of a complaint, respectfully, I don't think we get there, but in the event that the issue were one of when is a person a bystander, wouldn't that not depend upon the factual exposition?
Well, what facts at this point? So I think at this point, it's assumed, like you say, and I don't think it's disputed. I don't want to overstate 3M's like assumption for purposes of this, but it's assumed that one could foresee that people abuse the product and become impaired and drive impaired.
Right.
So that's already there. That's assumed. And let's even say there was a stipulated fact to that. So you don't even need to go to a jury on like a factual question. What is a jury supposed to decide? Is a jury deciding if it's already, let's even say we went farther and stipulated it's foreseeable. At some point, is there not a legal question that doesn't, or does it, belong to a jury as to whether it's too attenuated? How does that legal question come in? Is it only at proximate cause? Is it duty?
That's a very interesting question, and there is scholarly debate on that. My own view is that it's part of the cause-in-fact analysis and would go to the jury on an instruction.
It wasn't clear to me from your brief how far you were actually pushing that. I had the impression that I don't think there's any dispute that a manufacturer has a duty to people who use the product. And I thought you were suggesting in your brief that was as far as we needed to go. There is a duty here, so the district court was wrong.
Right.
But there's the separate principle that a person is not responsible for the harm caused by a third party. In this case, plainly, the harm was caused by the conduct of a third party. So don't we have to get into that analysis in order to address the issues in this case?
That's a very good question, and I appreciate your asking it. I can give you a couple aspects of guidance in that respect. I think the thing that will inform your judgment the most is if you look at Restatement Third of Torts, Section 37, Comment C. If I can just briefly read from that. This is the misfeasance, nonfeasance dichotomy. Restatement says at that point, misfeasance and nonfeasance have a long history as concepts used to explain the distinction between affirmatively created risk and merely failing to prevent harm. However, this distinction can be misleading. The proper question is not whether an actor's failure to exercise reasonable care entails the commission or omission of a specific act. Instead, it is whether the actor's entire conduct creates a harm, and this is the important part. For example, a failure to employ an automobile's brakes or a failure to warn about a latent danger in one's product is not a case of nonfeasance, because in these cases, the entirety of the actor's conduct, paren, driving an automobile or selling a product, close paren, created a risk of harm. This is so even though the specific conduct alleged to be a breach of duty of reasonable care was itself an omission. So with that background, an inherent aspect of any product liability case alleging defect would be that the manufacturer's affirmative conduct in creating a dangerous product and therefore in inducing a risk of harm, we automatically satisfy the misfeasance requirement under that dichotomy to create a duty.
Okay, so that gets us to the point where 3M manufactures this product with knowledge that it it's reasonably foreseeable that it'll be used by people to become greatly intoxicated. So we have an intoxicated person, but then there's the next step of what that intoxicated person does. Don't we have to have a determination that it's reasonably foreseeable that an intoxicated person will drive a car?
I think under the procedural context of a Rule 1202E motion that that would be assumed, since all inferences that can possibly be drawn in favor of the claimant must. But I believe at base, what you're really asking me is a superseding cause question. If cause is too attenuated, is it because of the criminal act of a third person?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily that. It could be that. But still, don't we have to make some determination about reasonable foreseeability all the way from manufacture to the injury? And here we have this intervening step. The person decides to
drive a car. The superseding cause argument?
Yeah.
I think that's where we wind up. But in terms of foreseeability, I'm going to respectfully suggest to you that that's almost always going to be a jury issue, even in a close case. Here there are no facts. There was not even an answer filed. Superseding cause as a defense is not before the court. Also, we've cited the court in...
Right, but I'm just trying to understand what we need to determine is reasonably foreseeable. It seems to me just on the pleadings of, just on the complaint, there's not a question even for us whether it's reasonably foreseeable that someone will become greatly intoxicated because 3M put Dustoff on the market. But the rule is that 3M's not liable for a third party's conduct. Here, the third party's conduct wasn't just using Dustoff. It was using it, getting intoxicated, and then driving a car. And that's what I'm trying to understand is do we need to be determining whether what an intoxicated person does is reasonably foreseeable, or is it just this hazard of just generally intoxicated people do crazy things?
I'm going to suggest to you that it can be either of those things. But if you go back to the very basis of cause in fact in Minnesota and the civil jig on causation, we adopted from the 1900s the Anderson test, which is if any chain of events occurs without an interruption, that relates back to the wrong and you have causation in fact. It's the old railroad cases where sparks hit dry grass and it communicates a fire from here to there. We don't worry about the ultimate event. A defendant is not required to be able to foresee the specific manifestation of harm, but merely that its conduct could produce a harm.
And so go ahead.
I'm sorry, respectfully, that is an issue we would be wrestling about were this summary judgment, not if it was judgment on the pleadings.
It seems like you want to move this, all to proximate cause. The foreseeability, it seems like to me, stops for you at intoxication, and otherwise it all goes to the proximate cause in this specific thing. So there would be a duty. I mean, people who are intoxicated could fall down, especially if it renders them sort of unconscious, fall down and hit their head. So someone who uses this could fall and hit their head and be injured. They could drive a car and be injured. They could drown. They could do any number of things. And so there would be a duty, it seems like, almost to anyone who when there's an injury that results, to the user or to another person. Where's the limit there? Is there one?
Well, we're not a Paul's graph jurisdiction in the event that's where we're going with this. But in the circumstances as to what must be foreseen, most Minnesota law and the way that a jury is instructed says that the defendant need not foresee the specific outcome. The key here, frankly, is that the duty would be discharged if there were a modification of the product that could avoid the intoxication, which leads to these events.
So is there a duty to everyone who's injured?
There's a duty to anyone who
is injured. Wait, right. Where's the foreseeability if not the method of the injury? I guess it seems to me you're saying we don't have to know, or even one doesn't have to see that it's foreseeable the person's going to drive, because it's foreseeable that they could injure themselves or someone else in myriad ways if they're intoxicated.
Right.
Is there any limiting principle there on duty?
On the duty issue, none that I can think of, quite frankly, because the issue becomes simply, what's foreseeable when someone becomes not just intoxicated, but so intoxicated that they lose complete possession and control of their faculties? I'm going to conclude in my last 8 seconds about the superseding cause issue. We cited the court to the Forsyth case, which says that that's not an appropriate decision to make within the context of a Rule 12 motion. Foreseeability should be raised as part of a summary judgment motion or reserved for the jury.
Forsyth?
I'm just wondering, I'm going to keep you over a second to ask this question. When you say it should be summary judgment, the question for me is, if there's an argument now that even assuming it's foreseeable that someone will abuse it and become incapacitated through intoxication, why does that need to wait till summary judgment? It sounds to me like what's going to be developed that makes that any more necessary to go to summary judgment than now?
We don't know.
We don't know what?
We don't know because there are no facts other than the facts that are contained in the complaint. And as long as the complaint alleges the fundamental elements and there's any way that the plaintiff could prove a case under those elements, then the matter passes through the threshold of judgment on the pleadings. And given our country's focus on merit-based decision-making, the facts get developed in discovery, and it gets presented either in an issue for summary judgment or is resolved by a jury.
What fact would need to be developed under your thinking as to whether a product that admittedly admittedly causes intoxication, and if you drive, you're going to be impaired. What do you need to develop if that's actually assumed for purposes of this motion that happens?
Well, if it's assumed, then we're done here.
Right. If we assume it for purposes of this motion, you're saying, I'll ask 3M what it is that they're assuming for purposes of this motion. But what do you think is assumed for purposes of the motion now?
All of the allegations set forth in plaintiff's complaint, which stated a prima facie case for product liability with injury to a bystander. All of those are assumed.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jeanette Bezos, and I represent respondent 3M Company in this appeal. Getting right to the last point, we must assume the facts that are set forth in the 6-paragraph complaint, which are that William Buhlman was driving on a Duluth street, that he purposefully and intentionally inhaled 3M's dust remover product in order, in the words of the complaint, to induce acute intoxication, that he was so impaired by huffing this product, if I can use that shorthand, that he was unable to properly operate his car, and that the car went out of control and struck the plaintiff who was walking down a public sidewalk in Duluth. No amount of discovery is going to change
these basic foundational
facts.
Don't we also have to assume that 3M knew when it sold dust off that that could happen?
That was what I was going to get to my next point. So those are the foundational facts. I don't think any amount of discovery can change those basic facts.
And no, we're talking about discovery to know what 3M knew or should have known, and
right.
What are you assuming to be true relative
we
to
We are
that?
Assuming exactly what the complaint said, that 3M knew or should have known that it was being misused by huffing, by inhaling it to induce acute intoxication. So we accept this is true for the purposes of the motion. So
So not necessarily that 3M knew or should have known, and I don't actually know that people drive after this. I mean, that almost seems like an odd factual thing to prove up, but...
We're assuming exactly what's set forth in the complaint.
Okay.
So why with those facts, the assumed facts, why isn't it reasonably foreseeable that someone would be injured in a car accident by someone who's intoxicated by dust off?
So under either the design defect claims that the plaintiff offers should be followed, or under the reasonable duty to protect cases, we get to the same point of duty, which, as you point out, pivots on whether or not there was whether the misuse was reasonably foreseeable.
We assume that, don't we? I mean, the allegation in the complaint is that it is misused in that manner.
Right. So what Montemayor, which is the latest design defect case, tells us is that when the issue of foreseeability is clear, courts as a matter of law should decide it, and that foreseeability is a question for the jury if there's a specific factual dispute concerning a manufacturer's awareness of the risk. So there's no fact dispute here on Rule 12. So next, Montemayor tells us, we look to the defendant's conduct and ask whether it was objectively reasonable to expect the specific danger causing plaintiff's injury, not simply whether it was within the realm of any conceivable possibility.
Okay, so stop you there. It's plainly objectively reasonable that someone would become intoxicated. That's the allegation that we assume is true. So we're at that point, and we have somebody who is intoxicated. Why isn't it reasonably foreseeable that the next step in this chain would occur?
So the next step in the legal analysis is that, as a matter of law, the injury is not reasonably foreseeable when the undisputed facts establish that the connection, and one, this has been pointed out, whether the connection between the defendant's conduct, which is putting a useful household product on the market, and the plaintiff's injury is too attenuated.
The thing that bothers me on this in terms of attenuated, there's a whole body of law in our Civil Damages Act where if a bar owner gets somebody drunk or serves them and then they get drunk, the body of law says that they're responsible then if that person goes out and causes an accident. And there's all kinds of cases where that's occurred.
Right.
Why is that attenuated at all? I mean, we almost assume in the civil damages context that that will occur.
Well, the Civil Damages Act or the Dram Shop Act, I mean, that is statutory. And that was put into place for exactly this purpose, for exactly that purpose, to impose a duty because one otherwise didn't exist in the law. And we don't have a statute here. So if the connection between the danger and the alleged negligent act is too remote to impose liability as a matter of law, I'm sorry, as a matter of public policy, the courts hold there's no duty. And there's
there's some challenges in this case, including because it's not just a single danger. You know, when we're talking about the danger, I mean, we are subdividing it. The danger of becoming intoxicated, which is very... like 3M says, yes, we're assuming that for purposes of this. Then there's the danger of that the person will drive. I'm not sure whether that is assumed or not assumed for purposes of this motion. I suppose that it, or their knowledge that people will drive.
But that's not alleged in the complaint.
It's not alleged in the complaint.
But it is alleged that people, that 3M knew or should have known that people were huffing it. And I think we can draw from that that people who are debilitatingly intoxicated do foolish things.
Including driving, that's foreseeable.
But again, I mean, there's numerous cases on motion to dismiss that we cite in our brief, and some we don't. I mean, some are the ones that we cite from outside of this jurisdiction, the cell phone case. Of course, it's reasonably foreseeable that someone's going to misuse their cell phone while driving. And drive recklessly and carelessly and cause an accident. It happens all the time. That court found that it's just, there's no way of preventing consumers from using the phone while driving, but basically it's not sound public policy to impose a duty there.
So I think that's the next thing where his head is, even if, whether it's accepted for purposes of this argument in light of the complaint, or you get to the end of a trial, let's even say that we put to the jury the question of, is it reasonably foreseeable someone who is intoxicated will also drive and will cause an accident? And a jury decides, yes, that's reasonably foreseeable. There's still a legal question, is your argument, I think.
That exactly. There
is, that the court should nevertheless decide as a matter of public policy, this is just simply too attenuated.
That's exactly right.
What's the public policy that supports continuing to make a dust product if in fact, I mean, and I know, again, I sort of circle around, like, chronologically.
right. When
but if we assume that the product could be made differently without, that's proved, that it could easily be made to not be an intoxicant and serve the same purpose, et cetera.
I think what they argue is that there should have been a miscible bittering agent in it, which there was. And that was first argued here on appeal, and it appears nowhere in any briefs or complaint, and that had it been a miscible bittering agent, it might have deterred him.
Right. But why doesn't public policy then support
But the public
that?
Policy piece is that it just imposes too great a burden on manufacturers. People have
How do
gasoline.
We get into any of that, though, at this stage? We don't know anything about what burden it imposes on anybody.
Well, again, I think you just get to the issue of, is it too remote as a matter of law to impose liability? We see that. So here in the it's a case I did not cite in my brief, Laubach versus Isaacson, a case from this court in 1992. It's 1992 Westlaw 31367, and Minnesota Supreme Court denied review. In that case, a teenager was burned when he and his friends poured antifreeze onto a skateboard and ignited it. And the Court of Appeals concluded that the manufacturer of the antifreeze, even though it knew it was flammable and knew it was explosive, had no duty to warn that it was explosive because the use the boys made of it was not legally foreseeable. And that was as a matter of law, again, because it was too remote to impose liability as a matter of public policy.
Right, but because it was not foreseeable. Plainly, the use that this person made of the drug or the dust off was foreseeable.
No, but again, what the court focused on is the boy's intentional and obviously dangerous misuse of the product. Clearly, the complaint alleges that he purposefully inhaled it to become intoxicated.
So does public policy always, you know, I'm trying to pull it, like when I looked at it, I thought it was a cell phone case sort of discussion, and I might be wrong. Public policy is talking about sort of the utility of the cell phone, and, you know, but maybe it doesn't say that. I sort of I'm trying to figure out what factors do you figure out if a public policy should shut down a duty, and it seems like the only one is that public policy always says that there's no duty when someone is misusing a product. I mean, let's take your even
What
skateboard.
They talk about let's is the ability to control and control users who are bent on misusing the product and intentionally misusing the product, like the boys in the skateboard.
If that became a thing,
like
you know,
guns.
Putting antifreeze on your skateboard, and there are viral videos all over seeing that people are just doing it repeatedly, resulting in tons of injury. I mean, so it's very foreseeable. Still, public policy would say no. The manufacturer has no responsibility. It doesn't need to even go through a trial to show it's easily, you know,
correct.
Because
That's
someone is misusing the product.
Again, we know that people huff gasoline, people huff spray paint, people huff whiteout. They huff all sorts of household products, but legally, this court can decide as a matter of law that public policy, because of the remoteness from just manufacturing and selling a product that may be flammable or huffable, it's just too remote from the actual injury.
And the remoteness is defined by the misuse of it. That's what makes it remote?
That is very much a theme in the cases. I mean, they don't use those words, but when the aerosol airbrush propellant cases, the Walmart case from 2018, the Allen versus Walmart case, which was a dust remover product. Gun manufacturers, the city of Philadelphia and the Chicago cases, of course, gun manufacturers know that guns are misused to kill people and to maim people intentionally. But there's no legal duty to protect citizens from the deliberate and unlawful use of their product is what the courts have held. So that's definitely a factor. But you don't even need to get there. I mean, in the Whiteford versus Yamaha case that Montemayor relies on repeatedly, that's a product defect bystander case. where plaintiff age 5 was seriously injured while tobogganing down a hill when he collided headfirst with a child model snow scoot, which is a kid's snowmobile, that his brother had stopped at the bottom of the hill. His face hit the edge of a metal bracket. He was permanently disfigured, severely injured. And the plaintiff claimed that the bracket on the underside of the snow scoot made the snowmobile unreasonably dangerous. And the court recognized that Yamaha's duty was to protect the snow scoot's users along with those who might be injured by its use or misuse from foreseeable danger. And he says, Whiteford, the plaintiff, wasn't using the snow scoot. He was injured when he slid his toboggan into the stationary snowmobile. In other words, he was a bystander. And then it went on to say, the danger here was too remote to impose a duty on Yamaha and was not one which Yamaha was required to anticipate or protect against. In so holding, the court said, the Supreme Court said, a manufacturer is not an insurer and cannot be held liable to a standard of duty of guarding against all possible types of accidents and injuries.
But what's remote about an intoxicated person driving a car? I mean, that's a hazard that gets talked about a lot.
Your Honor, there's not a single bystander case that I'm aware of where that bystander had literally no contact and no connection with the product. When we talk about remoteness and what's attenuated, I mean, there can't be a case that's more clearly too attenuated than this one.
But there are also lots of cases that involve a user. I mean, most product liability cases involve a user. I can imagine some circumstances like a spontaneous explosion or something where that isn't the case. But they involve a user. So why shouldn't we be looking at the natural consequences of the user's conduct?
Again, it's a simple matter of being too remote as a matter of law. Again, you know, this may or may not be a Paul's Graf adopted state, but the court has clearly, the Supreme Court has clearly adopted the same for foreseeability purpose, for the purposes of duty, that same theory that it simply can't be too many steps away from the manufacturer's action.
So this is one step away, isn't it?
I think it's far more than one step away.
The intoxicated state is not a step at all. I mean, that's the assumption, isn't it? So we're just going from the intoxicated person to a person injured by their driving.
I think that the injury resulted from a series of choices and poor judgment made by Mr. Buhlman. First of all, he made the choice to purposefully inhale it for the purpose
right,
of becoming...
3M was aware of that, according to the allegations in the complaint.
He's aware that people would huff it. But then he made the choice to drive. And when he was so intoxicated he couldn't control the car, he made a choice to continue driving. And to drive down a crowded public street in downtown Duluth in front of a Walgreens, he made a series of choices that caused her injury. And whether or not, again, going back to whether this is a duty to protect from the criminal acts of third parties, which we submit it is, because she had no contact with the product, or whether this is a defect case, we still get to the same issue of law on remoteness. And I have 9 seconds, so unless you have anything else. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Rebuttal?
I believe that the stage of our argument has come to focus on this remoteness question, and I have two suggestions that I hope will help you with it. The first is I'm not sure these cases were cited, but I'm confident you'll find them. Erickson versus the Curtis parking ramp, and I know that some of you actually have written about these issues before, but in Erickson, that was a case that held a duty to exist to a parking ramp to protect a patron against the criminal wrongful conduct of someone foreseeably on their property, given the physical layout, lighting, and such of the structure. And here's the takeaway. The mere fact that a criminally irresponsible act is the ultimate manifestation of harm does not change the duty analysis that if you affirmatively create a hazard, you have to stand accountable for the consequence. The other case that comes most close, I do believe we cited this at least in the reply brief, and that's the Zerbe case, Zerbe versus Warren, I believe it is. That's the glue sniffing case in which there was a criminal violation, the procurement of this glue that was going to be used for huffing by underage purchasers. They violated the law by acquiring this product and misusing it in the fashion they did. The Supreme Court in that case as well said that there was a duty that was violated.
Is that because the statute was violated?
In that case, that was a negligence per se case. You're
because
correct.
Because it was sold to a minor.
Because of the sale to a minor, it violated the statute in effect at that time.
And there are many cases like that throughout the country where states do have such statutes.
Did you say there are many?
Yes.
You're exactly right. In this context, if I can come back to Judge Peterson, your observation about the Civil Damages Act, or what I would call dram shop law, there was an effort to distinguish your analysis there on the basis that, well, that's a statute. That's just a statute. But the part and focus of your question was on the causation element. Don't we assume that when someone becomes intoxicated, that the person who improperly intoxicated them is liable for all the foreseeable consequence? That's a common law analysis, not unique to the statutory scheme. It would be a common law causation analysis that would apply.
I think the point was absent that statute, there in fact was not a cause
wrong.
Of action. You think that cause of action exists at common law apart from the civil damages statute?
The Civil Damages Act replaced a common law set of rules. It superseded it. It abrogated it. But there was a pre-existing duty. And it's more probably appropriate to look at it not in terms of the dram shop law or the Civil Damages Act, but for the common law counterpart, the so-called dangerous premises case. It was the companion of the Soderbergh matter, Henson versus... the Uptown Drink was in part a dram shop case, but also a case in which the duty that existed was the duty not to overserve someone, make them predictably act inappropriately, because if you do, then you'll have a common law liability.
So you're saying that duty doesn't arise as a result of the Civil Damages Act.
It
existed. The Civil Damages Act provides the method for dealing with it now, but didn't create the duty.
And the two causes of action coexist. They continue to exist. It was applied most recently in the Henson case in 2019. It's a civil common law cause of action. But my point was a more general one. Your analysis is based on the causation issue, not the what creates the duty issue, like the child statute in Zerbe or like the Civil Damages Act in a dram shop claim. Your focus was on causation, and that's a common law inquiry.
Except that there is no duty unless there's some reasonable foreseeability.
And here...
I'm trying to understand how far the foreseeability analysis goes.
And I thought we'd gotten past that point based on the procedural
context. Isn't that
context.
What this all boils down to? I mean, even under your argument, doesn't it boil down to whether the injury here, the connection to 3M's conduct is so attenuated that it's not reasonably foreseeable?
And I'm suggesting if cases like Erickson make a owner of a parking garage liable for the consequence of a rape, that... this is definitely not attenuated, as your questions already pointed out. I'm over time, but if I could just quickly wrap up. The point is that it can't be too attenuated where intoxication leads to predictably wrongful conduct. I got to get home now that I'm intoxicated. I will drive my car. Could an accident occur when someone is not only so impaired that they lack the capacity to control the automobile, but also the capacity to make good judgments about whether they should be driving? I don't think that's a bridge too far. Thank you kindly for your questions and
Thank
hearing
you.
Our argument today.
Thank you both. Case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. We shall recess to consider our non-oral calendar. Thank you.